It's official. Iowa will lose a congressional seat. And while it's been expected, there are questions about what it will do to our clout in Washington. And those who led the effort to remove three Iowa Supreme Court justices in November are moving to impeach the remaining four and challenging in court Iowa's process for selecting justices. Fallout from the state's high court decision, which cleared the way for same-sex marriage in Iowa, is set against Congress's vote to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Today on The Exchange, we'll talk about those issues in our weekly politics discussion. Our guests this week are Rachel Caulfield from Drake University and Chris Larimer from the University of Northern Iowa. We'll also take your calls, emails, tweets, and Facebook posts. I'm Jonathan Aull, in for Ben Kiefer. The Exchange, coming up after this check of news from NPR. On Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull, in for Ben Kiefer. It's official. Iowa is losing a member of the House of Representatives due to the census data that was released this week. Also, Don't Ask, Don't Tell has been repealed. Meanwhile, the judges that were ousted in part because of their vote on same-sex marriage in Iowa are witnessing dueling lawsuits, one to try to keep them on the bench, one to change the merit selection system, and the Iowa House could take up impeachment for the remaining justices. Those topics and more on our weekly political discussion. Joining us this week from our Des Moines studio is Rachel Caulfield from Drake University. Rachel, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And from the University of Northern Iowa, Chris Larimer is joining us from our studios in Cedar Falls. Chris, welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you.
So let's start with the redistricting and losing a congressional member. We all knew this was coming. This had been projected for more than a year, really. But do we think Iowa is going to lose any clout having one fewer member of the House? Does this at all play into the First of the Nation caucus status that we enjoy, Rachel?
I don't expect it will change the First in the Nation caucus status. And I think, you know, the Iowa caucuses are such an institution, and it's such a great experience for Iowans. But I think it's also something that, you know, reminds the rest of the country that retail campaigning can still happen. Both parties seem to commit pretty easily to allowing Iowa to continue to go first. Are we going to lose clout generally? Yeah, we will. But I'm not sure from 5-4, I'm not sure we had that much clout to begin with, quite frankly.
Chris, what's your take on it?
Yeah, I generally agree with Rachel's assessment. I think when you talk about losing clout, I think looking at the aggregate level across the United States, when you look at the other states that are losing seats in terms of states that have similar policy interests as Iowa, with Illinois, Michigan, Missouri, Ohio, Pennsylvania, states where you have kind of a strong agricultural sector, I think Iowa losing one vote and those other states losing one to two votes, that's where you're going to see the difference in terms of losing clout.
Now, Iowa has such a strong reputation for its redistricting process mm-hmm. being free of the partisan rancor that happens in a lot of other states. The political climate's a lot different now than it was 10 years ago. Do either of you think anything changes this time around, or do you think Iowa will continue to move with its established process of redistricting that will maintain that oft-admired sense of how we draw congressional districts?
My sense is that they'll maintain it. Basically the legislature has three chances to be involved with the redistricting process. As you said, it's a very nonpartisan process. The Legislative Services Agency doesn't take into consideration partisanship or party ID of the district, doesn't take into consideration incumbency status. And so the legislature really just has to basically vote up or down on the first two proposals that are presented. And then the third time around, if they don't approve it, well, then it goes to the Iowa Supreme Court. So I think the legislature will want to at least have some say in the redistricting process. And, you know, if it goes to the Supreme Court, now we're talking about three new members on the Iowa Supreme Court. And so that's one more level of uncertainty. And so I don't see the process changing.
No, and I don't either. And I would note, for those who aren't familiar with Iowa's redistricting process, I would only note that, you know, across the country, redistricting is such a horrendously partisan and political mm-hmm. affair. And I get phone calls every year from people who are concerned about redistricting in other states who are kind of desperate to figure out how Iowa is able to keep this nonpartisan system, because it really is the gold standard in how to redistrict.
And if anybody's wondering, just look at the map of the 17th district in Illinois, or at least what's the 17th district right now. An amoeba shape would be concise compared to this. Now, it's not just redistricting at the congressional level, though. The census data will also be used to redistrict the Iowa legislature and those districts as well. Chris, do you think this is going to have an impact on how the legislature carries itself in the coming year?
I do. Essentially, with the new plan, you're talking about 1,000 more constituents per House district, because Iowa's population did grow. We did lose a congressional seat, yes, but our population did grow over the last 10 years. And as a result, you're going to see about 1,000 more people in each Iowa House district, about 2,000 more people in each Iowa Senate district. And that means, obviously, more constituents, more people that the elected members have to talk to and kind of figure out what their policy interests are. And so if you're a state legislator, you know, going into the session, that has to be in the back of your mind, thinking about, okay, I have a new set of constituents that I have yet to meet, that I'm going to find out who they are later in 2011. And so you may see some reluctance on the part of the legislative session this time around to push more extreme proposals, or at least pass extreme proposals. I think, you know, they may be likely to introduce some extreme legislation, knowing full well that it's not going to be passed, because as we saw with this election cycle and the 2006 election cycle, you can have outside groups come in and focus on a single issue and have a big effect on the election results. And so with more uncertainty about new constituents, I think you're going to see maybe a less extreme legislative session.
But isn't that, Chris, a little bit of a moot point, though, because having the houses divided, one in Republican control and one in Democratic control, and then with a new governor as well, doesn't that kind of supersede the issues of redistricting? Because those same things that you describe would be in place, because nothing radical is likely to get through when you've got opposing houses.
Yeah, I think so. I guess I would say it probably reinforces the likelihood of having a very mild legislative session in terms of policy.
If you'd like to weigh in on this or any of our other topics that we talk about today, our phone number is 866-780-9100. You can also email us at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. On Twitter, find us at IPR Talk, or submit a comment on our Facebook page. So in general, I know it's way too early to tell, but do either of you have a guess of our five Congress members, which one is probably needs to be the most concerned about how their district will change going from 5 to 4?
Well, I'm not going to go out on that limb.
Why not?
The Register put together some interesting figures on how far away some of these members are. And, when you have a state that's as geographically large as Iowa and yet population centers are clearly designated, it all kind of depends on what that bipartisan commission comes up with.
Yeah, I'm hesitant to be a prognosticator on this, but I would, with what Rachel said as far as what the Register put together, if you look at Boswell and Latham, those are obviously the two folks that live closest to each other. So,
they're like 35 miles away from each other.
Right. And you have Latham's district that kind of is sprawling from, central Iowa all the way up to northeast Iowa. And so my guess is that there may be some restructuring with his district, and that may affect Boswell. I think maybe one kind of side note with this whole congressional redistricting and the losing of one seat, it'll be interesting to see how this affects the diversity of Iowa's congressional delegation. I think, it's starting to be fairly well known that Iowa is one of two states, along with Mississippi, that's never elected a female member of Congress or a female governor. Now we come down to 4 seats. That's going to make those that much more competitive and make the incumbency advantage probably that much higher. And it may decrease the likelihood of electing a woman to Congress.
Well, and getting back to the redistricting issue, ultimately it would come down to if the redistricting commission would see it fit to put Story County and Polk County in the same district, ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
Considering that the their Polk, obviously the biggest county, and Story, one of the biggest counties, and whether they should be in the same district or not, ultimately, I guess. On another topic, as we heard in NPR News just a few minutes ago, the president has signed the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell into law. It's still unclear exactly when the Pentagon will enforce it. There's a lot of unanswered questions about this. To Rachel and Chris, what does this have any specific effect on Iowa, or where do we fit into this obviously national issue?
Well, it's obviously something that President Obama has been has been searching for, for lack of a better word. And it was a campaign promise. It's something that we heard about in Iowa first on the campaign trail. I do think, given the environment in Iowa following the retention elections and the issue of gay rights generally across the state of Iowa, I think it certainly sets up 2012 as a pretty polarizing year on the campaign trail.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Particularly, obviously for the Republican Party, we know that the social conservatives tend to be the ones that come out on caucus night. And so now you basically have, the Iowa retention election and now Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That's quite a bit of fodder for the Republican Party and for social conservatives and for those candidates that are looking to kind of appeal to that social conservative bloc in Iowa.
The Pentagon has said that they're going to follow the way the federal government has viewed same-sex couples in other respects, where they don't anticipate the partners of same-sex couples to get any benefits of military members. However, does this create an interesting issue for the Iowa National Guard and other states where same-sex marriages are legal, and to what extent are they recognized by the states?
Well, there's obviously if you have a member of the Iowa National Guard, they go into service of the U.S. military when they're called into service, and when that happens, they fall under the command of the president as commander-in-chief, and obviously Congress then in the service of the United States, Congress has the power to regulate their service. And so, those Iowans who are gay and lesbian, should they choose to be married in the state of Iowa, which is perfectly legal, then certainly under the Iowa tax system, they would fall, they would be eligible for any benefits of marriage under Iowa law. Under federal law, that marriage would not be recognized and they would not receive those benefits. So, I think this points to some of the policy problems that come up in a system of federalism. When you have states making policy and you have the federal government making policy and you have conflicting policies, these are real people and they're in the middle of it.
So if you're a Republican that is going to seek the presidential nomination in 2012 and you're coming to Iowa, what's the best thing to say on the stump here if you want to engender the support of the most number of Republicans in Iowa on the issue of same-sex marriage and Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
Well, I think you, if you're a Republican, probably the best thing to do if you're looking for turnout on caucus night is to talk about the fact that you were against Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and that you were a supporter of the retention vote. Those are probably going to be the two issues that are most likely to get the social conservative voters out on caucus night. Those tend to be the people who show up on caucus night tend to be the most partisan, tend to be the most active, and so those are going to be two issues that are going to be key on their radar.
Rachel.
This is something that I think nationally a lot of people don't understand is in terms of what actually happens in Iowa and who does turn out in Iowa. For the caucuses, I think any candidate who comes through the state looks at 2008 and says, "I want to be the next Mike Huckabee."
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any question about that. And you become the next Mike Huckabee by appealing to Bob Vanderplatz and mm-hmm. by appealing to the social conservatives.
Well, do you want to be Mike Huckabee in terms of the finish in Iowa? You don't want to be
right.
Mike Huckabee in terms of,
yeah. You're going to need to build a campaign beyond Iowa.
Yeah.
But in Iowa, those are the people you want.
Well, I think that's a good point too. Looking beyond Iowa, you have to play so far right in Iowa, and then immediately go to New Hampshire, and you have to kind of backtrack a little bit. And as we saw with Huckabee, that can be a little difficult.
All of this is happening while there's still more fallout of the judge retention vote, where three members of the Supreme Court were removed from the bench. Presumably, most of the people who voted for them were reacting to the same-sex marriage ruling, although you never know exactly what voters were thinking. But the organized opposition was definitely pushing that issue. Now there are two lawsuits going on, one challenging the merit selection system in general, one trying to claim that the ballot initiative that removed them was unconstitutional because it wasn't on a separate ballot, which are words that are actually in the Iowa Constitution. Dueling lawsuits. Rachel, do you think either of these have any merit, and do you think either of these are going to go anywhere?
Well, so we'll start with the system, or with the lawsuit against the merit selection system. This is a lawsuit that's being brought by James Bopp out of Indiana, and he and his law firm worked with four Alaskans to challenge the Alaska system of judicial selection, which operates much the way Iowa's does. And he lost that lawsuit, appealed it to the Ninth Circuit, where they lost again. The Ninth Circuit said that the plaintiffs in the case were, quote, hard-pressed to find any legal basis for the principles that they wanted to establish. So that case was not successful. They then went and worked with four plaintiffs in Kansas to challenge the Kansas system of merit selection, which is very similar to the Iowa system of merit selection. They lost that case in federal district court, and they've now filed a case working with four Iowa plaintiffs in Iowa. And the claim is that there are seven lawyer members of the commission who are chosen by eligible members of the bar, practicing attorneys across the state of Iowa. And then there are seven members that are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. And then the final member of the Judicial Nominating Commission at the statewide level is the most senior justice, who is not the chief justice. So that has been Justice Mark Cady. He will become the chief justice at the beginning of the year. And that means that David Wiggins will now take over as the member of the Nominating Commission. So his claim is basically that average Iowans get to have a hand in selecting the governor, and therefore have some role to play in the selection of the seven members of the commission who are selected by the governor. The other seven members who are elected by the eligible attorneys in the state, by practicing attorneys, the average citizen does not have a vote in that process. And so he says that violates equal protection. As I said, it's a case that has not been successful elsewhere. I guess it was yesterday, the state of Iowa basically urged the court to simply dismiss the case entirely. So whether or not that's going to go anywhere is, I think, if I had you seem to want me to take firm stands here. So
I
will go out on a limb on this one and say that I don't think this has a good chance of going anywhere. And that case, the arguments will be heard on January 6th by Judge Pratt. And then the second lawsuit,
yeah.
Do you want me to keep going?
Please do. Please do. You're our legal mind here. Go ahead.
The second lawsuit was filed by three attorneys who argue that the Iowa Constitution requires that the judicial retention questions appear on a separate ballot. And by combining judicial retention questions with other political races, including the gubernatorial race and House races and Senate races and ballot questions, by putting them all on the same ballot, that that would violate the provision requiring a separate ballot for retention votes. So they originally had filed asking for an injunction, which would have prohibited the results of the November election from going into effect. That effectively would have kept the three justices on the court. The justices basically requested that they drop that request for an injunction. In other words, the justices will leave on December 31st. So they've dropped the request for the injunction, and the lawsuit itself will move forward at this point. So I don't expect that this case will go very far either.
Well, why is that? Because if the words separate ballot are actually there, where's the wiggle room to say that making it a question on the end of a ballot with other questions, with other referenda, with other elections is not a separate ballot? Or will the court just shrug it off?
Well, it has huge political implications, and by means of tradition, the retention election has always appeared on the same ballot. Mm. And so traditionally, it doesn't seem to have caused any significant harm. And this is another question in both of these cases. In order to bring a case in court, you have to demonstrate actual harm. And I think in both cases, that legal principle, it's called standing, that legal principle is weak at best. How have these plaintiffs actually been harmed? So I think that might be a way for the court to negotiate this issue in this particular case.
Now, the other issue that's out there is some members and incoming members of the Iowa House drafting legislation to impeach the remaining four justices. Chris, do you think that this is going to go anywhere, especially considering your earlier comments of reluctancy to do all that controversial stuff?
No. I'll try to make a prediction here, too, since Rachel's doing it well. But,
we are walking out on limbs now.
Yeah, no kidding. I don't see it going anywhere. And, you know, if you look at the politics around this and the two cases that Rachel was discussing, you know, you don't see Governor-elect Branstad supporting any of these. You even see the incoming Speaker of the Iowa House, Craig Paulson, kind of backing away from these. And so I don't see that lawsuit going anywhere, or that call for impeachment going anywhere.
So can we just expect in the coming year a lot more grandstanding, a lot of people saying things, a lot of both sides of this issue trying to rally their troops by bordering on the provocative or going directly into the provocative and not a lot of action? Is that a fair statement?
I think so, particularly when you combine it with you know, the 2012 caucuses.
I was going to say, we got to.
I think, yeah, absolutely.
We're entering 2011. Yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say, you know, one more thing, back to the redistricting thing and thinking about kind of grandstanding and everything. Gallup just released a poll saying that, you know, approval of Congress is now at a new all-time low. We thought it bottomed out at 18%, but now it's actually down to 13%. So with Iowa losing one member of Congress, at least Iowans now have kind of one less member to loathe in Congress.
Yay.
Yay.
We'll talk about that issue and much more. Your phone calls at 866-780-9100. Email us at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. On Twitter, we're at IPR Talk. Also reach us on Facebook. We'll be back with Rachel Caulfield and Chris Larimer, Politics Day, here on The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull, in for Ben Kiefer. IPR News is coming up next. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Day. We're talking with Rachel Caulfield from Drake University, Chris Larimer from the University of Northern Iowa. Also taking your phone calls at 866-780-9100, your tweets at IPR Talk, your emails at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Right now we're talking about Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the judge retention issue. Got some phone calls. We're going to go to Al in Des Moines. Al, welcome to the program.
Thank you. While I was very disappointed in the outcome of the retention vote, I feel it appropriate to point out, and you might want to discuss it, the requirement of the separate ballot. The retention ballot was on the opposite side of the large sheet. The main side was the governor and all of the other candidates. but would not, you might wish to discuss, the retention ballot being on the opposite side, I would argue that that might constitute a separate ballot. What say you?
Well, I Rachel, go ahead. I think you made a good point earlier on this.
Well, I think it could. having said that, these are all the considerations that the court is going to have to have to take up when they take up this case. The fact that the case itself is now separated from the issue of whether or not these justices will leave the bench at the end of the year, I think is actually helpful for the case because.
Yes.
The court can actually take some time, look at the ballot itself, look at the constitutional language, look at the history that Iowa has had in terms of placement of judicial retention questions on the ballot. I think technically it's entirely possible that you could say that's a separate ballot. Having said that, there are other questions on the back of the ballot.
Well, if the court were to rule that way, that wasn't a separate ballot, would that not call into question every other retention vote in the state of Iowa where the retention question was on the same ballot, front side or backside? And doesn't front side or backside depend on where you're voting? Because in some places where it's the only measure on the ballot, it would be on the front. But in some areas where there were a lot of races, it could be on the back.
In Des Moines, it was on the back side,
sure.
And only the retention was on the back side. And the other side was the other thing.
I think a lot of that depends on what county you're in and how many local referenda or community college districts, those kinds of things.
Well, the fact that the three justices are going to abide by the vote and leave on December 31, I would expect Vanderplatz is going to make some hay out of that.
Or maybe they just want to get on with their lives.
Right.
Al, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. Let's go to Mark in Wilton. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hello. Real quick question. I'll take the answer off the air. Iowans, I think, always get upset when outside money pours into the state for causes they may not care about otherwise. I've heard, and please confirm if you would, that Mr. Vanderplatz will be getting a $125,000 salary from a group in Mississippi to bring the whole gay marriage issue to the front for the caucuses. Is that accurate? And if so, who is this Mississippi group? Thank you.
Well, Mark, before you go, I'm just curious
All right. He's gone.
Rachel or Chris, do either of you know whether this is a fact or not?
I have not heard anything about this.
I've heard a rumor, but I certainly could not confirm it.
Yeah.
The group that really spearheaded Iowans for Freedom, and if you went to the Iowans for Freedom website, and that was the group that opposed retention for 2010, if you go to the Iowans for Freedom website, down at the very bottom where they identify addresses and what have you, it says it's a project of AFA Action, and AFA is the American Family Association out of Tupelo, Mississippi. Certainly that effort was led by a group out of Mississippi for anybody who wants to, put the dots together.
And it would make sense that he would be getting paid like that and, that they would try to increase their efforts. I mean, obviously 2010 was a big success for them.
Well, and in the interest of fairness, though, there was also outside money that went into the defense of it. There was certainly outside money that helped fund the lawsuit that led allowing same-sex couples to get married. And that's why I wished that Mark had stayed on the phone, because I just wanted to put that question to it, is that if outside money is bad for one side of the argument, is it equally bad for the other side? Is that a fair question?
It is. I think – the groups that initially brought the lawsuit, I think that's a little less of an issue, only because, at heart, all of the plaintiffs were Iowans, and they all brought that case. There was a local law firm that argued the case. This was, they coordinated the case. I'm not sure they spent a ton of money per se. I think the concern, what voters really seem to object to in terms of money is campaign money. Like, we put a lot of time and energy into worrying about campaign money and the evils of campaign money. And money is spent by special interests every day in all different formats, whether it's lobbying state legislators or bringing court cases. And so to consider that full range of money is important.
We have an email from Andrew who wants to know if Rachel and Chris believe that the dismissal of the Supreme Court judges will make it more difficult to find impartial people to serve on the court. Chris, what do you think?
You know, I guess I'm curious about that because, it does make you wonder what the applicant pool is going to be like for the Iowa Supreme Court. You know, how many people are going to be willing to apply? Obviously, it's a very prestigious position. But certainly in the back of your mind, you have to be thinking, okay, 2010, you know, a ton of money was poured in over a single decision. Do I really want to go to a bench where it's become highly political or increasingly political, where in the past it maybe not have been? It had been fairly nonpartisan. I think the Iowa Supreme Court was looked upon favorably across the country. Now, in terms of being nonpartisan, now it does make you wonder, is this Iowa Supreme Court sort of in a transition from kind of nonpartisan to the perception of being very partisan? And it may have an effect on the applicant pool.
And certainly, you know, the three justices who are appointed in January, or we assume it will be in January, early February, whenever the spring, they will be up for retention in 2012.
Right.
So, you know, there's a very immediate effect of 2010, I think, on people who are considering the position. I've heard mixed reactions from people in the legal community. Some have said that they expect that they'll get a larger applicant pool because there are three vacancies. So there's a better chance of being selected because there are more positions available. And some people have said that they think there will be a smaller applicant pool because of the, you know, the heightened sense that this is not a position that's secure, certainly not when you have to be up in 2012. And I should note that the nominating commission will meet and review all the applications, and the interviews with selected candidates will be available on the internet live stream for anybody who wants to view them. And that's the first time that that's happened.
Let me ask both of you a political strategy question. For the Iowans that wanted that disagree with the same-sex marriage ruling, would it have been better for those people to put their time and effort, instead of dismissing three judges, into putting that same time, effort, and money into electing Republicans to the state Senate? Because if a few more had been elected, the Republicans would have controlled both houses, and there would be presumably a constitutional amendment process started that would have made it through. Because right now it appears that Senator Gronstahl is the only person standing between that happening or not. Was this a miscalculation from conservatives by putting their effort into ousting a few judges instead of putting those resources to controlling the Senate and having more real long-term action on this issue and other issues that they may believe in?
Yeah, in hindsight, it probably was, in terms of actually having substantive change that they would have agreed with. The change that they got was, in large part, obviously we lost three justices, but they, you know, it was very symbolic in the sense that, you know, it doesn't change the gay marriage ruling. And so in hindsight, yeah, that may have been the way to do it. But I think in terms of firing up folks to get out to vote, you know, as Rachel said, people don't like campaign money. They don't, and they don't like campaigns all that much either.
They don't
like watching the election process.
We love democracy. But
right.
We
just
campaigns.
Don't want to do anything with it. Yeah. We just don't want to participate in it. And so I think, you know, focusing on the judicial branch, that was kind of something new and exciting that you could actually excite the base with.
Let's go to the phones. Carol, who's driving south of Des Moines, joins us. Carol, welcome to the program.
Yes. Good morning. Good afternoon. I'm sorry, I lost track of time and I forgot to change the clock in the car. My question is for Rachel, since you seem to know quite a bit about the Iowa Supreme Court. Can you give an approximate number or an average number of cases per year that they decide. I think if this one question, this one decision is put up against the number that they decide over the year, it might put it more in perspective.
Well, I have to say, I don't know the exact number of cases that they decide each year, but over the course of their careers, these justices have decided thousands upon thousands of cases.
I know that, but I don't know what number, because the way I want to answer questions that are put to me, I'm a registered Republican, and when people ask me what I think, what I say is, can you name me another case that those three justices decided on that you did not like?
But
are just flummoxed.
Carol, though, when you look at the history of, let's say, the United States Supreme Court, when you talk about landmark decisions from the United States Supreme Court, you're really looking at a list of maybe 50 cases or less. And even though the U.S. Supreme Court disposes of thousands and thousands of cases, we still talk about Buckley v. Valeo, Plessy versus Ferguson, Brown versus the Board of Education. It's those landmark decisions that define who we are as a culture. So, yes, I see your point. But
I wouldn't even mind knowing the number of landmark cases in that instance.
Then you get into a very sticky situation about defining landmark.
Right. But all I'm saying is, I think maybe all of us should put this in perspective.
Yeah, and it's, you know, this is a situation that goes on across the country. It's not unique to Iowa. State Supreme Courts have typically been, quite frankly, kind of ignored by the, by the public, and state courts in general have been kind of ignored. You know, those who pay attention to landmark U.S. Supreme Court decisions, those are seen as really important because they affect the entire country. But, you know, the business of state courts really hasn't gotten a lot of attention. The judicial selection and retention process in the past, in the past 10 years, 12 years, has gotten a lot of attention. And that's largely because there are some groups that have figured out that one way to get voters really excited is to start talking about the work of courts, because courts have a really really fundamental political problem in that half of the people who walk out of the courtroom are unhappy with the decision. That is always the case. They don't have a built-in group of supporters who are there to defend them as easily as other politicians might have. And quite frankly, judges in most states are not politicians. They don't know how to run a campaign. Right. They don't know how to raise money. They haven't had to do it. In some states where judges are elected in partisan elections, they are political, and judges know how to run campaigns.
I have lived in Texas. Trust me.
Yes, there you go. That would be one of them.
Thank you very much for your call, Carol. We really appreciate it.
Yep.
I guess being a member of the state Supreme Court is like being the holder of a football kicking unit. Nobody notices you at all unless they think you messed up.
That's right. Exactly right. Yes.
And Rachel and Carol are absolutely right. You know, as Rachel well knows, a lot of times in the past, we've always had ballot runoff when we get to these judicial elections, right? You know, people won't turn over the ballot. They don't recognize the name of all these justices. They just won't vote for them. But yeah, if you kind of can get out, if you're an outside group, and say, hey, there's this thing on the other side of the ballot that you can have a big effect on the election if you vote for it, then, you know, that's something new and exciting for a voter. Whereas before, you know, they're just voting for governor or state representative, and they feel like there's not a lot of change when they vote for these folks. By focusing on the judicial election, it was something new and exciting.
Let's talk about the Senate, the U.S. Senate, for a moment here. Last week, they had a vote to cut off debate and actually take a vote on the START ratification treaty. That vote will be soon, and all appearances are that it's going to pass.
It seems to have the 67 votes.
Right.
Was this a tempest in a teapot? Was there really legitimate because the people who complained about the treaty just seemed to say over and over again that the administration didn't negotiate a good treaty, and they didn't seem to go into a lot of specifics.
Yeah, I think that's the case. I mean, you know, it was interesting thinking about, you know, if you go back to the Bush tax cuts and you go to Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and most likely with the START treaty, those are three issues where I think the public generally wanted them to happen. They were in favor of the tax cuts, but yet we saw a lot of political bickering back and forth. You know, for the most part, the public was, the majority was in favor of repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And my guess is if you ask people about reducing the number of nuclear weapons, they were probably in favor for it. But, you know, you still want that political grandstanding. If you're a Republican, you just had a good election result. You don't want to be seen as all of a sudden giving something back to the other party.
And this would seem that, that for a lame duck Congress, they've done an awful lot. I mean, some big profile legislation has moved in, again, a lame duck session.
Yeah. They're, you know, I think one of the things that's going on right now is that you have a number of senators who are realizing that, you know, they got to get things done because come January, there's a new sheriff in town. And certainly President Obama and the Democrats are saying, you know, this may be our big chance to get agenda items done. The U.S. Congress is an incredibly polarized institution, less so in the Senate than in the House, but incredibly polarized institution. Kind of to come full circle, you know, one of the reasons that we have low public approval of Congress, and certainly Chris can speak to this more, but one of the reasons we have low public approval of Congress is that we have a polarized party-driven Congress, and part of the reason we have a polarized and party-driven Congress is that we have a redistricting system that allows a lot of hyper-partisan decisions to be made. Congressional districts at the House level are crafted for, you know, for incumbents and for political party gain. And so, when you don't have a lot of competition out on the campaign trail, and you know, people get into office, they know what they have to do. They follow their party.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with Rachel. You know, when you have this polarizing process, or when you create the sort of this polarizing Congress, particularly in the House, as Rachel was saying, you know, that then you have the two sides basically talking at each other and not coming to an agreement. And if you ask the public, you know, what's the one thing you don't like about Congress? We know that approval is really low, but what actually don't you like? It's this constant sense of bickering and inability to compromise. And as Rachel said, that's going to be the natural result of the redistricting process.
So if we look at this lame duck session of Congress, they repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell, passed extension of the tax cut, extended unemployment, long-term unemployment benefits, ratified the START treaty. If it looks like that's going to happen, if all those things do come to fruition, who's the winner in this? President Obama, congressional Democrats, congressional Republicans? Who? The American people, maybe? Who's the winner?
They're
part of this, too, I understand.
They are.
Yes. There's a rumor.
You know, I think the American people are in terms of getting policies that they generally are in favor of. I think President Obama, certainly if he doesn't win, it's probably a draw. Members of Congress, I think, are probably the losers in terms of both parties because, you know, there's still this sense of, you guys, you know, this is something we want and neither one of you can get it done.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think, you know, I've heard a lot of people say this, but, you know, for somebody who was so roundly or seemed to be so roundly defeated in November, President Obama is doing pretty well right now on his agenda items. And, you know, at the end of the day, these are going to be remembered as Obama's policy initiatives. They're not going to be remembered by individual members or, you know, as the initiatives of individual members of Congress who are on their way out. At the end of a session, I think the Democrats and Obama look good here, and I think that the American people generally favor most of the policies that are going through, if not all of them.
So, looking at everything that's happened at the federal level and in Iowa this past year, as we go into 2011, and the GOP candidates for president are going to start camping out here a lot, more so than they already have.
Say they're already here.
Yeah, they're already here. They'll even more so. They'll start picking up their mail here as well.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Who goes into the political climate that exists right now with a leg up? And if you're not interested in giving a name, what kind of Republican is the one that goes into this year in Iowa as a presidential hopeful in the best position? Chris?
Thank you for going.
Nice. I guess, you know, I would probably say Huckabee again is certainly going to be viewed favorably. Certainly there's name recognition now with, you know, all the hype and media attention surrounding the retention vote, something that, you know, he was very much in front of the public when it came to talking about. I would say Huckabee. You know, some of the other folks in terms of Pawlenty is a oh, I'm sorry.
We just need to make sure not to let Rachel
off
the hook.
I'm sorry.
Rachel.
Yeah. Oh, no. I think the social conservatives right now do really well. Huckabee, obviously, you know, has a base in Iowa and is looking at that. But I think more generally, you know, it's going to be an interesting year. I think we have various factions that are going to be competing.
Rachel Caulfield from Drake University, Chris Larimer from the University of Northern Iowa, thank you very much for being on The Exchange. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Mitchell Schmidt. Technical support from Dennis Reese, Phil Moss, and Rob Dillard. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk show is Jeff Schmidt. I'm Jonathan Aul, sitting in for Ben Kiefer today. Thanks for joining us.